It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert here with Rob Ferret, and we're talking D&D right now with the author of Dice and Men, talking about the appeal of Dungeons & Dragons. And Rob, you are a card-carrying geek. I know, right? You play this game.
True.
I'm going to go out on a limb. I'm going to guess that when you played, you were an angry, mystical elf.
You know what? I was usually in charge. I usually ran the game.
The Dungeon Master.
Yeah.
Game Master.
So, yeah. So I'm one who doesn't remember the characters particularly because I was on the other end of the game.
But if you were a character, elf, right?
Probably half elf, I guess, would probably be the way to go. Because you're best of both worlds that way,
okay.
Honestly. Yeah. Yeah. Well, anyway, you can join in with your Dungeons & Dragons memories or what you're doing these days at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Send an email to talk@wpr.org. And we'll go to the phones now. We've got Alan with us on the line. He's in Madison. Alan, hi. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you guys doing?
Real good. How are you?
I'm very good. I'm actually running a D&D game tonight.
Tonight?
Excellent.
Technically Pathfinder, which is a updated version of it, but yeah, it's a lot of fun for me. It's a chance to do acting because I don't have time to do that anymore in my life. I used to do a lot of community theater growing up, and I've always thought of it as radio improv.
Okay. And do you play with the same crew over the course of years, or whoever you can round up on any given night?
No, it's an ongoing story, so it's the same people. We play every other Tuesday. And yeah, they're currently going through a story. They're actually trapped on a desert island. So it's a lot of fun to get out of your own head. And it's helped me actually a lot in my business life, understanding other people. By every week, I have to be in somebody else's brain.
Huh. All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing your story, Alan. Is that a common story, David, do you think, from players?
It is. A lot of people talk about how Dungeons and Dragons and other role-playing games really change their life in positive ways. You know, one of the guys that I've been role-playing with and that I write about in the book is in the advertising business. I live here in New York City. He's an advertising executive, and he's our dungeon master. He runs our game. And he's said that he's been in big meetings with a client. You know, there's millions of dollars on the line, and he's had to improv something. You know, somebody asks him a question. He doesn't have an answer. They ask him about some sort of ad campaign. He has to make something up on the spot. And that's a skill that he developed and honed as a dungeon master. It's what taught him to tell a story and to make up something on the spot and have the story be interesting and to know your audience and to really pull them in. There's lots of stories like that from lots of different people.
I also noticed Alan did not exactly sound like a 13-year-old boy. He's a businessman. So I guess that means that, you know, grown-ups are playing it. A lot of them.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of grown-ups are now. There's a lot of people who just never stopped playing, people who started in the 1970s and have played all the way through. There's also been people like me. I played a lot when I was a kid and when I was in high school and then stopped for about a decade and just started again recently. There's a lot of people who are coming back to the game, you know, now that they are older, and it's people who see it as, you know, well, like the caller, he has a game every other Tuesday. We have games every other Tuesday. We make time for it, my friends and I, because we know our time is so precious. This is such a great way to sit down with your friends and enjoy yourself.
All right, let's go to another call. We've got Travis next in Green Bay. Hey, Travis.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. I just wanted to say that D&D and actually role-playing games in general, just a huge part of my childhood growing up. I started playing with a buddy of mine, must have been, I don't know, 10 or 11 or so, and we started playing every single weekend. We'd just get together and we'd sleep over at my friend's house, and I think we were about maybe two or three published campaign books in, and my friend, who was just a huge fantasy guru, I mean, everything, you know, from Magic the Gathering, you know, fantasy books and all that, he decided that the published books weren't good enough, and he would write his own. And I mean, he would just spend hours and hours and hours in writing and coming up with different campaigns, incorporating characters from different stories and things like that into our own D&D world, while still keeping like the basic rules the same.
That's a cool story, Travis. I have a question. Do you think that playing that when you were younger and being so immersed at a time when a lot of kids are starting to get into trouble, did that keep you out of trouble?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, teacher would bust us actually playing during class, which I guess, it kept us out of serious trouble.
Right. Which is... All right.
But,
well,
yeah, definitely.
All right, David, what do you think of that?
It's a familiar story. I think it's, you know, I think it's good for kids. And I think that, you know, it resonated for me when he talks about how, you know, they went off and made their own rules. And this is a game that promotes creativity. You know, it made me think of Jon Favreau, who is the director of Iron Man. He says that he learned how to tell a story from playing Dungeons and Dragons. It was those first games that got him thinking about narrative and thinking about the parts of a story and how you hook people in and when you, you know, keep the action slow and when you get it fast. And so many people who have played this game have had that experience of, oh, you know what? I want to do something creative now. I want to write my own rules or write my own novel or movie or play or whatever else.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Travis. We'll go now to Nathaniel and Eau Claire. Nathaniel, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hey there. I wanted to say thanks for the show. It's a great program. I also wanted to say there that I'm a playtester of currently of D&D Next and 5.0. I absolutely love it. I just wanted to know if you wanted to talk about that in the last couple minutes here, you know, about how maybe it's more towards role-playing rather than fighting, like the more recent versions that have come out. I'd also like to give a shout-out to Fountain of Youth Gaming in Eau Claire and Sarge, the owner of that.
All right, thanks a lot. So the future of D&D, they keep reinventing this thing, huh?
Sure. Well, it's a little bit of a challenge as a game publisher. You put out your game. If I buy a box of Monopoly, I've got Monopoly now. I'm never going to buy another Monopoly unless I lose that set. So one of the things that role-playing game publishers have done is over the years they've changed the rules. They'll release a new edition. Dungeons and Dragons is now on its fourth, and they're working on the fifth. And what they're trying to do with this new edition is to sort of round up all these vast groups of old players, the people who maybe got left behind, you know, people who were second edition players and who never converted to third or to fourth. The fifth edition aims to bring everybody back together in a kind of universal rule set where they're really emphasizing simplicity of play. They're not bogging down people with rules, and they want it really to be about the fundamentals of the game, about exploration, about storytelling, and about having a fun experience with your friends.
Oh, well, it's been a lot of fun to talk about. David, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
David Ewald is a journalist and the author of Dice and Men, the story of Dungeons and Dragons and the people who play it.
Coming up next, we'll talk to an expert about military intervention in Syria.
But first, the clothes of a Hollywood icon are going on display in Appleton. The late Katharine Hepburn was known in part for popularizing the wearing of slacks by women. Patty Murray has this report.
The personal collection of Katharine Hepburn's performance clothes features more than 40 items the actress wore on the Broadway stage and the Hollywood screen.
Why she kept the things she kept, we don't know. We only wish we did.
Jean Drusadeau directs the Kent State University Fashion Museum. She's also the author of the book, Katharine Hepburn, Rebel Chic. Drusadeau was invited by the actress's estate to a warehouse in Connecticut to inspect items that were instructed to be given to charities or schools. The display at Appleton's Trout Museum includes an iconic little black dress.
Very late. What's
this? Oh, well, that's the star of our show. She's the evening dress from Adam's Rib.
If clothes make the man, costumes help make the actress. Seeing them up close makes Hepburn seem more human.
You can learn that someone like Hepburn had a 20-inch waist and a 23-inch rib cage and not much more either above or below, and that the designers were very skillful in giving her a figure that was absolutely glamorous on film.
Whenever you see clothes, you know, you go through a museum and you think, God, people were so much smaller. They look so big on the screen. They're so outsized.
Yes, and the day I came nose to nose with Sylvester Stallone, I knew that was true. You know, he's no taller than I am at 5'4.5". But Kate was unusual for her time. She was 5'7".
At the time, most actresses were no more than 5'2". Besides glamorous gowns, the display includes many pairs of slacks. When Hepburn began her acting career in the 1930s, it was scandalous for a woman to wear pants. She didn't care.
She was one of the first people to wear slacks in public and popularize it and make it okay. Other people, like Marlene Dietrich, had a different twist on slacks. Or Greta Garbo was a foreigner and very mysterious, and she had a different twist on slacks. But along comes Hepburn, who's from an old New England family, American top to toe, and she wanted to be comfortable.
The Trout Museum normally mounts fine arts exhibitions. Angie Bleck is a spokesperson for the museum and says fashion is now considered to be just that. Fine art.
There are a lot of exhibitions throughout the country right now focusing on fashion design. The Chicago Art Institute has the Impressionists with a lot of the paintings and the costumes that went along with the period. So, you know, there's a lot of big interest in fashion and fashion as an art form as well.
Hepburn won an Oscar for the 1981 film On Golden Pond. The Trout exhibit has an ensemble of khaki pants with a blue shirt worn over a white turtleneck. It looks like something the actress wore in that film, but Druzzito can't verify it.
There's a makeup stain on that collar that looks to me like it would be the right place if she were nuzzling Henry Fonda, but there's no indication that it's really from On Golden Pond.
Hepburn died 10 years ago at the age of 96. The exhibit begins September 13th and runs until mid-December. Patty Murray, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks, Patty. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks, Kristen. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time.
Yesterday, Secretary of State John Kerry confirmed that chemical weapons had indeed been used last Wednesday in Syria.
President Obama has referred to the use of chemical weapons as a red line throughout the more than 2 years of violence that have taken place in Syria, and now it seems likely that the United States will intervene in some way.
We'd like to hear your thoughts on a possible U.S. intervention in Syria. Do chemical weapons make U.S. action necessary, or should we stay out of the conflict? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
Daniel Serwer joins us now. He's a scholar at the Middle East Institute and professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Daniel, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
So at this point, does it look pretty likely that U.S. military intervention in Syria will take place?
It does look likely at this point, but probably a very limited narrowly defined intervention. At least that's the rumor at the moment.
Tell us about that. What are the rumors out there about what we might do?
The rumor is that the intervention will be limited to punishing and degrading the capacity of the regime to use chemical weapons. That would require us to target very carefully against units of the Syrian army that handle those weapons and the command and control structure that may have issued the orders to use them. It would not include a much broader objective of driving the situation towards a negotiated solution or even causing the fall of Bashar al-Assad.
Some folks were asking early on whether this meant that the U.S. would target the chemical weapons themselves, and tell us about the status of that.
The odds are that they won't do that, and the reason for not doing that is that you may spread the weapons and cause more deaths than you want to. These are very dangerous chemicals that can really wreak havoc on a civilian population.
What about adding on more targets? You talked about military targets. What about targeting main points of location of the Assad government?
The rumor mill says that that's not what they're going to do because of the limited goal that they're defining for themselves. And, you know, it's much easier to get political support both domestically and internationally for the more limited goal, even if, you know, in the best of all possible worlds, I might like to see a broader goal that would drive us towards a negotiated solution. But that's why we pay the president the big bucks to make those decisions.
Well, is he going to be making that decision on his own, do you think? Or will he go to Congress, as some people are hoping he might?
He's already consulting with the Congress. I don't think they'll call back the Congress to meet on the subject or to pass a resolution. But there's every indication that there will be ample consultation with the Congress and that the intervention will fall well short of what would require congressional action. he also has an international audience to play to. I think you're going to see in the next couple of days some effort to roll out the evidence against the Assad regime and to bring about as broad a coalition of the willing as possible.
So there has been some news this morning that Britain has recalled Parliament early, presumably to look at this. What do we know about that situation, about having allies as we go forward?
Well, I think we're expecting to have at least Britain and France. I think Turkey is a prospective ally for this action, and they're hoping to bring around some Arab countries at least to support it verbally, if not to actually participate in it. The Arab League has already indicated support.
Now, we've talked about how this, at the moment, seems to be a very slender action that we're going to take. It's not going to be a huge, sweeping military effort. It's going to be very targeted, very streamlined. So maybe that will diffuse public response. But can you give us a sense of how people are responding right now in America and abroad?
Well, I think in America, people are skeptical and reluctant. There are risks associated even with a narrowly defined intervention. There could be a Hezbollah response with terrorism against American targets around the world. It is also possible that a very targeted effort will be seen in Iran as reducing the credibility of American military intervention against their nuclear program. So there's a risk in that direction as well. Abroad, I think in Europe, people are feeling about this pretty much the way people in America feel about it. It's really unfortunate to feel compelled to do this. Europeans are as disgusted by the use of chemical weapons and other weapons, for that matter, against civilian populations as Americans are. But they have a lot of other things on their minds, including a financial situation which is still very fragile, and a lot of other problems that they'd like to tend to before getting to Syria.
Now, the chemical weapons used last Wednesday killed a reported 1,300 people, about 100,000 people have been killed so far in this conflict. Tell us about why this motion by the United States seems to be happening now.
Because you can gain broader support for action against the use of chemical weapons than you can for action against the use of more conventional weapons, which have killed many, many more people. This is just one of those ironies on Earth that the prohibition on the use of chemical weapons is regarded as a strong one. It's regarded as morally repugnant to have used them. And unfortunately, in my way of thinking, the killing of 100,000 people with more conventional weapons has not aroused the same kind of international revulsion.
Now, it's almost been a week since the chemical weapons attack. We had a confirmation from Kerry yesterday that, indeed, you know, he thought that we have proof that chemical weapons were used. When do you think we're going to see this military action?
I think we still have a little while. It's always difficult to predict the decisions of a single person, and this decision depends on a single person, Barack Obama. But it seems to me that he still has some political work to do, both domestically in the United States and with potential supporters of the action. I think he'd be well advised to do something about presenting the evidence in public. And, you know, there's pressure from the UN now to withdraw the inspectors who are in Damascus looking into previous cases of chemical weapons use, to withdraw them before any military action. That's quite understandable, though I'm not absolutely sure that we'll allow that much time. The Secretary General wants them to be able to complete their mission, which is scheduled to be over on Sunday. So I won't be surprised if there's another week or the better part of a week before anything actually happens on the military front.
We're talking with Daniel Sewers, scholar at the Middle East Institute and professor at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins.
You can join the show at 800. You can join the show at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll check out the news now and then go to your calls. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
We'll continue our conversation now with Daniel Sewers, scholar at the Middle East Institute and professor at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, talking about Syria and the possibility of U.S. intervention. You can join in at 800-642-1234.
You can also leave a thought on the Central Time Facebook page, and we'll go to the phones now. We've got Benjamin joining us in Germantown. Hi, Benjamin.
Hello, ma'am.
What do you think?
I just wanted to make the cut. I'm sorry?
I just said, what do you think?
I personally, I don't care too much for the issue of chemical weapons. I'm sure they are serious. But the issue that I think people are missing is that the Assad regime is now listening to its people. It does not care about implementing change or increasing their movement towards democracy. And just their lack of respect of life is very, very surprising. And one little other point, I think we can learn from what we did in Afghanistan and Iraq. Instead of throwing hundreds of thousands of troops in, we can have a light footprint approach with aircraft in the air and maybe some advisors and maybe a small military force and just kind of getting them into the transition and let them take over early.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that, Benjamin. And Daniel talking there about how he's not as worried about the chemical weapons, obviously. They were a horrible news story last week. We saw a loss of lives, but he thinks that it's time for the U.S. to get involved for broader reasons.
Well, I agree that there are crimes against humanity occurring every day with conventional weapons. The degree of American involvement, though, I think is not going to include ground troops, at least not at this stage for sure. It's only going to be from the air and with standoff weapons at that. I just don't think at the moment there's stomach for much more than that in the United States.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that call, Benjamin. And let's go next to Andrew in Milwaukee. Hi, Andrew.
Hi there. How are you?
Doing fine. How are you?
Good.
What do you think, Andrew?
My question is, I guess I've been listening to the show for about a half an hour, and I think I might be missing something. I'm not sure what the hard evidence is that where these chemical weapons came from. I know that Joe Biden and Kerry are absolutely sure that this has happened, but have the American people been informed on what the evidence is?
Right. Andrew's point that we don't know yet. Obama hasn't spoken to the American people. What's the proof, Daniel?
I don't think we've seen the proof yet. The president's going to have to speak to the American people. I think they're going to have to put out some sort of document that tells us what this evidence really is. I'm reasonably certain that it exists, but we've had enough of these situations in the past that your listener is quite right to insist that there be clear evidence before action is taken.
Can you give us an idea of what kind of evidence would be sufficient, what you expect to see when that comes out?
Well, you know, there are many ways that this can be done. One way is to, you know, there's a rumor in Washington that there are actual intercepts of the orders going to the soldiers who fired the missiles, to load them and to fire them. If that exists, publication of those conversations or written orders or whatever they were would be, I think, a step in the right direction. I don't know what other evidence they may have. There is certainly some eyewitness testimony that the rockets came from government-controlled territory. It's you know, frankly, a little difficult to imagine that the opposition, which is on its heels at this point, would be capable of preparing and loading missiles to fire it itself. But at the same time, there are those who argue that the regime would have been stupid to do this while the inspectors were in Damascus as well. So I think people are quite reasonable for people to say, show me.
And do you think President Obama will do that? And if so, when?
I certainly hope he'll do that. I hope he'll do that soon. It will satisfy some people and not satisfy others. But I haven't seen the effort made yet to document the basis for the military action against Syria.
All right, let's go next to Stephen in Sun Prairie. Hey, Stephen.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for the show and thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to be real quick. Those that forget their past are doomed to repeat it. People don't remember the Gulf of Tonkin, and I remember about 2002, 2003, 2001 time period, we were absolutely assured that there were WMDs in Iraq. You know, and I would like to express my disappointment that there has been absolutely, essentially no anti-war comments from the news media, including public media. Regarding the sanctity of human life, anybody that thinks that an escalation of military strength and war is going to result in saving human life is just a bit naive. Fighting war for peace is like drinking for sobriety. Thank you very much. Bye.
All right. Thanks a lot for that call, Stephen. And Daniel, will we see more people like Stephen who are saying, hey, hang on a minute, we're moving into this too fast and maybe repeating some mistakes?
Well, I certainly think it's legitimate to ask for evidence and to refer to the Gulf of Tonkin and to refer to the non-evidence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. I think those are important precedents that need to be answered by the administration. I think the president has been very clear that he wants to be absolutely certain before anything is done. Now he has to present what evidence he apparently has seen in some form, and it's difficult to present all of the evidence in the most detailed form, but in some form I think he has to make the case to the American people. As for the question of whether military action at this point will save lives or cost lives, it is absolutely true that our willingness to escalate doesn't mean that Bashar al-Assad won't escalate further and either using chemical weapons against his own people in an even greater quantity or responding with Hezbollah terrorism, for example, against Americans all over the world. There's a very real possibility of escalation here, and I can't rule that out. This is why, as I said, we pay the president the big bucks to make these calculations and to make sure that whatever we do is clear and forceful enough so that escalation and response is clearly going to be pointless.
Daniel, you led peace-building work in Iraq and Afghanistan, Sudan and the Balkans with the United States Institute for Peace. What do you see as the main challenges for reconciling Syria going forward?
The longer this war goes on, the sharper and deeper the cleavages between the many different sects and ethnicities in Syria. And one of my concerns is that if this continues, it's going to be very, very difficult to put Syria back together again, as it was very, very difficult in Iraq, even with very large numbers of American troops on the ground. In Syria, you're not going to see large numbers of international troops on the ground, and it could be that we're going to see a situation, if this continues much longer, in which the Syrian state fragments. And if the Syrian state fragments, you have the risk of fragmentation as well in Lebanon, in Turkey, and in Iraq, as well as undermining the state in Jordan. That's a very nasty scenario. So I think one of the important things here is to end this as quickly as possible, preferably ending it with a political solution, with a negotiated solution, which is what the administration is on the record as favoring.
Well, Daniel, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
We've been speaking with Daniel Serwer, a scholar at the Middle East Institute and a professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He also blogs at peacefair.net and has a forthcoming book called Writing the Balance, How You Can Help Protect America.
Now we'll check the headlines and then talk about putting the culture back in Wisconsin agriculture. You're listening to Central Time on WPR.
Thanks, Kristen. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. As summer draws to a close, those who have plots in community gardens or at home are starting to reap the benefits of the food they've planted earlier in the year.
But according to our next guest, these gardens aren't just about the end result, the food, but rather the cultural connections that people have with cultivating the land and growing crops. And it's important to look to the past and understand the troubled relationship sometimes that has existed between race and agriculture.
Our guest is Venus Williams. She's director of Alice's Garden. She wrote a piece for the current issue of Edible Milwaukee called Preserving the Culture in Urban Agriculture. We've got a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page. Venus, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with what you think a community garden should be, the potential. What are some of the functions they should be fulfilling outside of the food itself?
Community gardens have an opportunity to bring people together whose paths may never cross in an urban area. So the growing of food, I always say, is the carrot, pun intended, to get people to come into a garden to explore who their neighbors are, to explore what kind of food and food traditions others in the community and in the city have, and to really address multiple issues related to health and food and culture.
And you say in your piece that a community garden, an urban garden in a place like Milwaukee shouldn't, again, just be about the food. It should look at the history of the people's relationships to food and in some cases the tales of struggle and injustice related to growing food. Can you talk about what you're looking for there?
Sure. As an African American, my relationship to food is very different than an European American. My relationship in this country to food and land is one that is burdened with historical trauma. It's burdened with stories of slavery and sharecropping, so that many people, when they arrive in urban areas, I have heard it often said, I will never grow anything again, because they still have memories of growing up in the South, memories of working land that maybe did not belong to their parents or their grandparents, working land where there still were so many injustices happening on that piece of land. And so part of my task is to help people unpack that baggage related to food and to reclaim the growing of food in a healthy, healing way.
Well, that's really interesting. Coming from that perspective, why the heck would you garden? That's something that people were escaping from, this agricultural work that was seen as that was oppressive in the past.
Right. Well, if you have control over what you eat, you have control over who you are. Many of our issues related to health and wellness are all about what we consume. And so by not growing your own food, you're handing over power to others, no matter who you are, no matter what your historical relationship is with land and food. So my opinion is everyone needs to be growing something that they eat, because everyone has to eat. So when you couple it with the historical connections with land and food, whether you're speaking of it from the African-American perspective, whether you're talking about it from a Hmong refugee perspective, we all need to heal our relationship with land and food.
Well, let's talk about how this works on the ground and tell us how you do these things and confront these issues at Alice's Garden.
One of my favorite Alice's Garden stories is related to when we reconfigured the space, and there were people who had been gardening for a decade, and they were gardening in monolithic communities. So the Hmong farmers were all gardening together, and the few African-American gardeners who were there at that time at Alice's Garden were gardening together. When I mixed them up and put them next to one another, it was a challenge because people, no matter who you are, always used to things being the way that they are. Folks don't want to change. But what has happened because of placing people who were not growing food next to one another, to folks from different parts of the country, different parts of the world, the exchange of ideologies, the exchange of agrarian traditions, the exchange of gardening know-how really came to life, and people really started getting to know not just the food that other folks were growing, but why they grew them and who these people are. In Milwaukee, we have had many bridges to cross related especially to Hmong farmers and the African-American community. And one of the things that we're very intentional about at Alice's Garden is building that bridge of understanding between the Hmong and the African-American community.
You must hear some great conversations. What do you hear in that back and forth between, say, the Hmong gardeners there and the African-American gardeners?
The conversations that happen very often, especially when new gardeners come in, is the different vegetables that the Hmong farmers grow that many of us are not familiar with. And when you ask one of the Hmong farmers what that is, they may not have a name for it. So they compare something that looks like a cucumber, a traditional cucumber that we're familiar with, but it's not a traditional cucumber. And so we also get into cooking, and we get into community gatherings that really explore the culinary traditions, not just the different traditions in growing food. We talk about companion planting. So when I hear stories of gardening traditions with the families, eventually it leads to stories about the children and family. And obviously, we all realize that we have way more in common than we don't have in common. So it's a beautiful place to be grounded, not just in farming and food, but also in understanding who really occupies and lives in the city of Milwaukee.
When people start talking about these food traditions, do you get a sense of pride that maybe they didn't know was there as they realize their food heritage?
Without a doubt. I think more importantly, what happens is people see one another fully as the human beings that we are. And so whether we're talking about the Burmese refugees who are some of the new members of the Milwaukee community, or some of our sisters and brothers who have come in from different parts of Africa, when people really start to interweave their lives through food and through the growing of food, community is built in a powerful way that you cannot turn back from that. I will often hear people say that when they come to Alice's Garden, it's like walking into a piece of Eden. And if the Milwaukee community outside of the fence could represent what is felt inside the fence of Alice's Garden, this city and most cities would be a wonderful place to be.
Let's talk about that. Are you trying to plant the seed of this idea elsewhere in Milwaukee and beyond?
It is wonderful that the urban agriculture community in Milwaukee is very well connected, and there are so many of us who are on the ground, no pun intended, doing this work, building gardens, helping to build community. What I like to really push and stress with my colleagues is it has to be about more than planting physical seeds and planting plants. It really has to be about planting programs and impacting the quality of life for the residents if it's just on that block or in that four-block radius. So community gardens present an opportunity for us to really go deeply into the lives of the community, and we just use food as that entree into their lives.
How about younger people? Do a lot of youth participate in this, and what do you think they're getting out of it?
Without a doubt, I can speak for Alice's Garden and say this summer we engaged more than 30 young people on a daily basis in the growing of food, representing four, five different organizations in the city of Milwaukee. And so young people tend to be more open and not as set in their ways when it comes to being introduced to something new and different. So we have programs such as the Healthy Corner Store Initiative that my husband actually runs in the garden that hires young people from the community, and they grow food for local corner stores. We have organizations such as New Life and Urban Underground and Running Rebels who all are part of Alice's Garden, reintroducing young people to some of the traditions that their ancestors had and must be joyous that we are reclaiming.
And are they joyous? Do they, apart from the food itself, do they hear the stories that, the other gardeners are telling and get a sense of who they are, where they came from, what is still there to overcome?
It is an intentional part of what we do. Our Earn and Learn program is called Garden Mosaics, and Garden Mosaics is a curriculum that was developed out of Cornell University that is all about people, plants, and culture. And so in that particular program, it involves the interviewing of the elders. There's a whole curriculum that's built around getting to know the food traditions of everyone who is present in the garden. So we are very intentional about the intergenerational and multi-generational learning that happens at Alice's Garden.
Venus, what in your life made you take on this and make it such a big part of your life?
There are so many different ways to answer that question, and we have like a minute left. I will say that the first garden that I can recall is that of my Choctaw great-grandmother and my African great-grandfather, Nellie and Henry Hoots. I remember that garden because I was scolded always for running through the corn.
Uh-oh.
But I also remember that kitchen and all the food that was taken from that garden into that kitchen. My grandmothers both have had gardens that I helped be a part of. And my mother still has her garden. And so urban gardening, although we like to think of it as something new, it really isn't anything new. It is something that some of us really grew up with. But had you told me back then that I would become an urban farmer, I would have laughed at you. So the seed was planted a long, long time ago.
Venus, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
This is Venus Williams, director of Alice's Garden. Her piece, Preserving the Culture in Urban Agriculture, that was in Edible Milwaukee. We've got a link to that at the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up next, we'll explore the growing trend of the childless city and what, if anything, should be done to bring families back to urban areas. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.